And later, as a teenager, and then even later, as a young adult. I remember as a child, there was one thing that I wanted for years, and that was to settle down in one space and stay. As a teenager, my values and my wants changed, and I guess they really reflected being a teenager. I wanted a glamorous career, and I wanted a huge house, a mansion. But when I turned 18, started over here at Ventura College, my goals and my desires changed a little bit. I became obsessed with having a 1934 Dodge pickup with a small block V8 in it so that I could carry my Harley 500 in the back of it. Yeah, I hear a lot of yeah from the guys, yeah. All of my wants, though, through all of those years of childhood and teenagers and young adulthood were all about me. Because as a child and as a teenager and as a young adult, my life was all about me. In the Ten Commandments, God impressed upon Israel that their lives were not to be all about them. Their lives were to be about God and about other people. When Jesus was asked thousands of years later, what was God's greatest commandment? He answered that question in Matthew chapter 22 and verses 37 through 40. And he said that the first and greatest commandment was to love God with all your being. And he said the second was like it. It was to love your neighbor or other people as you love yourself. Last Sunday, we talked about the human quest for meaning in life and the fact that one way or another, at one point in time or another, we all have that quest for meaning in life. And that search for meaning led us to the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, because in Ecclesiastes, the author, who calls himself the teacher, addresses that issue and that quest and that series of challenges in life. Ecclesiastes is the observations of a man who's lived long and has paid attention to life in its details. And as a man who has an enormous amount of wisdom because he's paid such attention to it, and arguably because God has given him a great deal of wisdom. And as he reflects these observations through life, this book of Ecclesiastes serves as a discussion guide for people who want to think through their response to God's unseen hand in life and in history. It offers insights to thoughtful readers, not casual readers, about developing a God-centered worldview. And this worldview that it offers, God is creator, sustainer, judge, planner, and determiner of both temporal and eternal life. And every human being is subject to God in all things. The author, this teacher as he describes himself, is extraordinarily wise. He describes himself as wiser than anyone who lived in his time or before. And yet, even he, this extraordinarily wise man, lacks the wisdom to discern the purposes of life in God's scheme. After his best efforts, he's only discouraged. So he begins with his theme as he opens this book called Ecclesiastes. And he says, meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. As we go through this short book, we find that the teacher does not contrast human wisdom with the wisdom of God. He seems to focus singularly on how human beings see life, what human beings experience in life, and what we come away with as a result of that. But also as it unfolds in these observations about life, this book of Ecclesiastes subtly but powerfully demands that you and I admit to the limitations of human knowledge and human wisdom and human philosophy. Essentially, what comes away is this thing that we've come into our language and our culture to say today, and that is, we don't know what we don't know. I mean, the more we know, we understand the less we know. The more we know, we have more questions, don't we? And so we're aware that there are many, many, many things that we don't know. But we also realize that we don't know what we don't know. That there are things beyond our grasp, things we haven't even thought of that we don't know. And that seems to be at work in what this writer has to say in Ecclesiastes. And so after railing against the endless cycle of the sameness of life that he begins with in chapter 1, and what seems to him to be the pointlessness of it all, the teacher begins to detail specific ways that he has tried to find meaning in life. And so in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning in verse 12, and on through the end of chapter 2, he tells about his devotion to study and explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven, as well as to study madness and foolishness. Doesn't that seem strange? You and I might think about, well, I want to study by wisdom, by knowledge. But the writer wants to see it all, because even madness and folly are parts of life that cannot be denied. And so he gave himself to pleasures of wine and other kinds of foolishness by his own admission. He said, I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. Was it wisdom? Was it madness? Was it folly? Was it something else? And so he pursued great building projects. He built great houses and vineyards, great gardens and parks, great reservoirs and groves of trees. He obtained numerous slaves and herds and flocks. He obtained massive amounts of silver and gold and other treasures. And he obtained men and women singers, and he obtained harems. I don't know about you, but I can't see the point of obtaining great harems. I can't handle one woman, much less as many as that man had. All of those things, though, all of those things gave his heart a short period of joy, but none of them accomplished anything lasting. And as a result, he viewed all of them as being meaningless. Did they accomplish some things? Well, yes. Was there value in each of these things? Perhaps. But at the end, none of them gave him meaning in life. And so he said in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, in verses 17 through 23, so I hated life. Wow. Can you imagine yourself doing all that this man did? Accomplishing, if you will, all he did, obtaining, achieving all that he did, and then saying, but I found it meaningless, and I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? What will he do with these things? Will he maintain them? Will he enhance them? Will he let them fall apart? Will he tear them down? Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. You know, when you reach the end of your working years, whatever work you've done, and you realize you're going to hand it over to other people, whether it's someone who's near your age range or quite a bit younger, if you've worked hard to accomplish something in your work, and then you think about handing it over to somebody else, unless you have a great deal of faith in that person, in their character, in their abilities, it's hard to do it, isn't it? It's hard to think about a lifetime of work given to someone else. And you begin to think about yourself. Have I worked all these years for nothing? Is there going to be any trace of the value, of the worth of what I've done that will follow after me? He goes on to say, this too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This, too, is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun? All his days, his work is pain and grief. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This, too, is meaningless. Wow. I would hope and pray that none of us reaches the end of our working years and feels that way about what we've done. I would hope that all of us can feel like I'm proud of the work I did. I worked conscientiously. I worked with the idea, as the Bible speaks, of not just working for my boss, but more importantly, working to honor God. And I can walk away from what I've done and be proud of what I've done and not have to worry about what happens to it after I'm gone, because that's no longer my responsibility. Seven-year-old Jason had just left for school. His mother began to get about her busy day, and suddenly she heard a knock on the front door. And so she ran to the front door, she threw the door open, and she stood face to face with Jason. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "I've quit school," he answered. And mother screeched, "Quit school?" Calming herself down, she asked, "Why have you quit school?" Jason answered, "It's too long, it's too hard, and it's too boring." And mom replied, "Jason, you just described life. Get on the bus." Through the eyes of a child, all of Jason's life was about himself. Similarly, everything that the teacher, this writer of Ecclesiastes, pursued was about himself. It is not talk about the idea that he decided to do this because of how it could benefit his city or his nation or the world. It is not talk about doing this because this would honor God. It is not talk about doing this because he has a sense, after much prayer and seeking of God's will, that this is what God would have him to do. There's none of that. For the teacher, it was all about himself. The teacher acknowledged God's presence, and he acknowledged God's provision, and he saw himself as subject to God, a man who was submitted to God. But he says nothing about seeking God's will in his life. It's no wonder that he saw life as meaningless, because his life was all about himself. What about us? If we're Christians, by virtue of the fact that we're Christians, we acknowledge God's presence. We acknowledge God's provision. We acknowledge that we are personally subject to God. We think of ourselves as worshipers of God. We think of ourselves as intentionally, conscientiously trying to live a godly, moral, and ethical life. But as we go about our daily life, is our life all about God and others? Or in actuality, is it all about ourselves? Are we seeking meaning in life in ways that are all too similar to the teacher? Are we trying to build our own empire? Are we trying to build our own position? Are we trying to build our own wealth? Are we trying to impress other people? Are we trying to build a great retirement? Or have we found that those things lack lasting value and meaning in life? Do we make a habit of seeking God's will in our lives each day? So that life is not all about us, but it's all about God and other people. The teacher then makes these observations in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verses 24 through 26. After all of this whining about meaninglessness in life, he says, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. Well, thank you for acknowledging God. Thank you for realizing that God does bless us. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Indeed. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. He continues this idea of meaninglessness as he reflects upon the cycles of life. In chapter 3, in verses 9 through 15, he expresses his appreciation and his confusion at the same time about what God does for us, both giving us joy in the midst of meaninglessness. Read with me, if you will, beginning with verse 9 on through verse 15, when he says, what does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil, this is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so men will revere him. Whatever has been, whatever is has already been, and whatever will be has been before. And God will call the past to account. This is the central theme of Ecclesiastes and of the teacher here in Ecclesiastes. Life is not about me. Life is not about what I do. The meaning of life is not about what I obtain or what I achieve. The only meaningful life is found in God and in the hope of eternity that he's put in my heart. I don't have to understand why God has designed the world and the way it works as he has. And I don't have to. I will find meaning in life by enjoying all that God has given me in life. I will find meaning in life, therefore, by praising God and looking forward to what I have in eternity with God. And while what seems like the meaningless of life in this world will pass, the meaningfulness of life eternal will endure forever. This life is just preparation for the life to come. It's a short window of time that has but a speck in relationship to eternity. The teacher goes on to complain about injustice and about oppression, about envy and about loneliness, about advancement and riches, about possessions and honor and inheritance, all of which to him, and indeed to us, seems grossly unfair and makes life meaningless in so many ways and so many times. And yet the teacher's greatest concern and his greatest question is about what happens to us after our physical death. Isn't that our greatest question and concern? It was a song that became famous decades ago by Peggy Lee called "Is That All There Is?" And I'm reminded of that song so much because that was the recurring refrain, "Is that all there is?" That was a central question then, it is now, and frankly it always has been, hasn't it? Whatever situation of life we're in, however great and however awful, we're asking that question just like the teacher did. Is this all there is? Well, this is meaningless because this is going to go away. In one fashion or another, it's going to go away. Is there nothing that lasts? Is there nothing that endures? What about life itself? Is this lifespan all there is? And if it is, and everything goes away, why have it to begin with? The teacher asks, who knows if the spirit of man rises upward? And who can bring him to see what will happen after him? He asks, for who knows what is good for man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen after the sun, after he is gone? But the teacher knows that each of us is accountable for how we live. And so he says, God will call the past to account. Jesus' follower Peter impresses that idea upon Christians and non-Christians alike in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 1 through 6. He says, therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he does not live like the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. He doesn't live for himself. It's not all about him or her, you or me. If we're Christians, then we live for the will of God. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans chose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. And those things are still very much at work today, not in societies that are primitive only, but in all of our well-advanced societies, including our own. They think it's strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. And to one extent or another, we've all been the recipients of that. But they will have to give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was preached even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the Spirit. God makes our lives meaningful. God makes every person's life meaningful, but it's meaningful only in relationship to Him. Life is meaningful only when you and I live according to God's will. When I was a child and a teenager and a young adult, life was all about me. That's where I thought I would find meaning. Didn't you? Jesus' follower Paul wrote, "When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. I put me behind me," Paul is saying. "I put what I wanted behind me. I found meaning in life was not wrapped up in me. Meaning in life, true meaning in life, was wrapped up in God." Where are you seeking meaning in life? Truly. That's a question each of us has to ask ourselves. And frankly, we have to ask it rather frequently. Because it's so easy for us to drift, isn't it? We get started well, and then we drift. And we come back, and we go for a while, and then we drift. And we come back, phase after phase of our lives. Where are you seeking meaning in your life? What is your life all about? Only God offers the life that He calls truly life. If that's not the life you're living now, God is calling you right now to come to Him, to change that to Him, and to find meaning and satisfaction and joy and peace. And if we can be of any help to you in that, we urge you to come forward right now as we stand and sing this song.